This is Aiden with Oddball Pilot. I'm back in Seattle, and I'm sitting down with Alex Haynes again. And we're going to talk about a few planes that Alex has been flying over to China. He's been flying some Quest Kodiaks. I think he's just taken four of them over in the last 2 months, 3 months. And so it's not going to be a discussion so much about the flight over, although we'll talk about that a little bit. It's going to be more about what he sees with aviation in China, both general aviation and sort of where these smaller air taxi-type airlines in China might what they might be doing, what they might do with these Kodiaks, and he's taken a series of caravans over in the past. And then, of course, kind of what it's like to fly around China airspace, air traffic control, etc. So, Alex, let's start. You've recently been taking these Kodiaks over, and let's talk about the flight briefly. You go up, you've been tanking them here in
Well, it makes sense. I live in Seattle. The Kodiaks are made in Sandpoint, Idaho, and I can catch a Horizon flight over in the morning, get a rental car to Sandpoint from Spokane, and be back at Boeing Field the same day. We put the ferry tanks in. I'm working with Kenmore Air, which is fun, and with their wheel operation down at Boeing Field. And then from there, it's a 3 or 4 day journey over to the final destination in China.
Going up through Alaska, Russia, and from Russia straight into China, correct?
Yeah, so two stops in Alaska, two stops in Russia, and then just the destination in China.
And your issues are usually weather-wise going up into Russia, from what I understand.
Every stretch of the way is winds and weather.
Wintertime.
Yeah, the first one I took this time was the 2 days before Christmas. And the shortest day of the year.
That's right, and there is some bad weather up in Nomes. If I recall, there had been in the previous weeks that you'd been waiting on.
Now, I've gone through, the North Pacific route a bunch of times before, but it's never been really in the dead of winter like this.
Right.
And I've had longer days and warmer temperatures. This is the shortest days of the year and, literally the dead of winter. It's really cold in Siberia, and the weather could be doing anything. And the weather systems move through really fast, so I've had to I've had to educate myself and get more in tune with the weather patterns there, because you really need to anticipate what's going to happen before you start, or you may end up getting stuck and spending a bunch of extra money somewhere. As part of the art of doing this is anticipating weather delays.
And spending money, it's also your time.
Absolutely. I got a family, and I can't just... even if the company's going to put me up in a hotel for a week, I don't want a week away from my family.
Especially when it's Anchorage and you're only a day flight away from your family.
This happened a couple of weeks ago. I was actually in a jet. I know I digress here, but I ended up, being four nights in Anchorage, and I was considering just catching a flight home just to be home for a day.
Right.
And spending what it would have been over $1,000, and I couldn't do that.
Right, the hotels in Anchorage in the wintertime aren't bad, but in the summer they can run $150, $200 a night.
Yeah, we're getting $100 a night in the Millennium, which is a good deal.
Well, and they've got a good bar downstairs.
Yeah. Lots of Alaska hammer.
And the other considerations are, of course, someone's thinking about this is you need a visa for Russia and for China, which take time to get.
Yeah, I got them last fall. I got multiple reentry visas, which is ideal, and they're good for a year.
Okay.
You can't always get that because you got to pay a little more for that, so you need to justify paying a little more for that, and it takes a little longer for them to process that because they can.
Right.
And my passport was out of my hands for 3 weeks last November, waiting for them to do it, because what they said was the Russian embassy, they incurred the maximum period, meaning that they guarantee that they'll get it back to you within 2 weeks, but it could come back in a couple of days, especially when you've paid a passport agency here in the United States a much higher fee to have it expedite. You pay them like $200 or $300 extra, so that they'll expedite it. But then the Russians turn around and say, we're invoking the maximum time period, because they're processing it, you know, and so you have to budget for that time. You have to anticipate that that's how long it's going to take.
Right. But that was part of my problem with my visa in Tajikistan.
Yes.
Is it was rushed, and then they did things backwards, the passport agency, which caused... Anyway, that's a whole other story, but yeah.
But so it's a business consideration that, you know, your P's, you know, proper planning performance prevents...
piss poor performance.
Yeah, proper planning preparation prevents piss poor performance. Because I'd rather be stuck at home waiting for a couple of extra weeks rather than stuck, you know, somewhere else waiting for permission. So you got to get all your ducks lined up in a row before you actually leave home. And that's another part of the art of getting this job done efficiently.
Cool. And we'll be talking about that more in some of these ferry flying courses that we're putting together. We'll be going much more in depth into how to do all this international work. So but back to the China deal. So it takes you about 4 or 5 days if everything goes
well. In the summertime, I can actually leave out of Wichita with a tanked plane and I come home to Seattle one night. Second day, I refuel in Anchorage where the cheap jet fuel is and then go spend the night up in Nome. Second night. Third day, Khabarovsk. By way of Magadan or Petropavlovsk. So the third night is in Khabarovsk, Russia. So two stops in Russia. And then on the fourth day, I deliver in China. And it goes like clockwork. In the wintertime, I need to allow at least an extra day. Now, these flights, since I'm tanking them here in Seattle, what I've been doing is up to Anchorage and then out to Nome in the same day. I've managed to pull that off.
Well, that Anchorage leg's probably eight hours.
Yeah, nine or ten hours, depending on the wind. And this is kind of a detail, but when the weather is bad, you have good winds, and the weather is good, you have bad winds. Typically, in a, you know, going up from Seattle at 14,000 feet.
Right.
Then out to Nome, spend the night, and then out in the morning, and I've been going to Petropavlovsk. On the Kamchatka Peninsula, and that's interesting. I like going out there. And I've been spending the night.
And they have new fuel nozzles now.
Yeah, for 15 years, I've been going to Russia, and they've got these fuel nozzles that were made while Stalin was alive. And they're, this is another detail that we can take out now, but it's like everything in Russia is backwards. Their engines rotate in the wrong direction, you know. And one of the things is that the valve on a fuel nozzle, you push to open it, but when you release the handle, it depends on the spring pressure to close the valve.
It doesn't always close then.
So you can't manually close, you can't push the valve closed.
Right.
And if it's going at full blast and it wants to keep going, you know, you got to be really careful. Anyway, they got brand new fuel nozzles out there, and it was really exciting because these things, they didn't have these, they were much easier to operate, they worked better, they weren't so old, they didn't leak all over the inside of my plane. And it was more like what I'm used to, you know, refueling back here in the world and not over there where everything's backwards.
So it's small things.
Small things are big things, yes.
So when you get into China, I'm just thinking about airspace, to file a flight plan into China, is that it just a standard international flight plan then, or is there any different hoops you have to jump through?
Well, both China and Russia are authoritarian governments. And you can't do anything without permission.
Right.
So you can't just file a flight plan. You have to get permission to fly first. And they want to know when you're going to fly, your entry point, your altitude, everything. They want to see all your paperwork. They want to see your pilot certificate. You know, they want to see all the pilot credentials and the aircraft credentials and your insurance. Just to get permission. Then that goes through the central authority back in Moscow or Beijing. And then you get approval for this. Then you can file a flight plan.
I'm just going to throw this. My guess is if you're flying into the U.S. with a non-November registered airplane, you probably jump through the same hoops.
Yeah, and it didn't have to used to be so hard. before 9/11.
Right, right. Luther.
And I always say what 9/11 did was bring the rest of the world to us. I mean, you still had to usually get some kind of advance permission, but they weren't so particular about it.
Right.
But this is another digression. I had brand new airplanes coming out of Kansas that went over to Chinese registry right after 9/11. Brand new airplane, never flown, built in the United States, coming right out of the factory, American pilot with a long track record, but I couldn't get permission to fly because it was registered in China.
Right.
And so we had to learn all these new hoops to jump through, and they were time consuming.
Well, the government was scrambling to figure out what those hoops were at the same time.
Exactly.
So, yeah. So you get your permission. So it's not just an overflight permit. It's actually a little more complicated than like getting an overflight or
right. So if you want to go to Saudi Arabia, basically you just need to you need a couple of days notice. You can give them the aircraft registration. You don't usually have to send all the aircraft documents. They might need that. And then you'll get it. And China's different. You need to do this like 10 days in advance. Now, if you have a good track record with them and, you know, you've never irritated them by, causing them, you know, to feel like you're a pain in the ass or a thorn in their side.
In other words, then that would happen like if you'd gone in a few times without filing the correct paperwork.
You know, right.
And then, I've had this for some countries, well, you show up at the border and they're on the radio yelling at you and they let you in even though you haven't filed things and they kind of yell at you, but you don't want to do that too many times because then they start...
Then they'll start dragging their feet.
Right, yeah.
So, with Pilots International, we've got, many years, they started going into Russia and China, well, before the Berlin Wall came down, it was still a Soviet Union. And they work really, really hard from the office to make sure that everything is set up in advance.
So it helps when the paperwork shows up and it's flight internet and they know who the company is, then the authorities in China are
exactly.
Much more likely.
The authorities say, oh, we've dealt with these people before. They've got a good track record and they don't feel any like bad feelings that are going to cause them to drag their feet and giving you your permission. So this year, even though they say that they need 10 days notice, we've been getting our Russian and our Chinese permissions in just a couple of days.
Oh, awesome.
Which is unusual.
Cool.
But it's because of our relationship with them that they're happy to do that.
So Joe Schmo, private pilot, might have it. I mean, not private pilot, but a general aviation flight, just trying to do like a tour, might have issues.
They would definitely have issues. They would need to start well in advance.
Do you think in China, would they allow, if someone wants to do a world flight and fly around the world, can you even get permission?
Yes, you can. Okay. But it takes a considerable longer amount of time.
Got it.
And you're going to have to give more explanation. It's easy to, when you're going to China, very often you need a letter of invitation.
Right.
So if you want to do a general aviation kind of private flight around in China, inside of China, it would be really good to have a relationship. You can't just go in cold.
Right.
You need to have somebody there that's going to, you know, hold your hand while you're there. And then if they write a letter of invitation, you can give that to the Chinese authorities. Then it's going to be much easier.
Right. They know the system.
And in fact, that's very often one of the things that you need to have just to get the visa in your passport.
Yep.
So there's a lot of advanced preparation that, you know, you need before you can go over.
So that's kind of I'll jump around a little bit here. So general aviation in China, do you see any of it for Chinese privately owned aircraft?
They don't even know what general aviation is. To them, general aviation is a G5 Gulfstream.
Okay.
And they're, you know, I've been saying since I started going over there, that you know, quote, communist country is, you know, there's 1.3 billion people in China.
Yeah.
And there's a billion communists that are out in the hinterlands farming and dirt, little subsistence dirt farms. And a couple hundred million capitalists living in the cities, driving nice cars, wearing suits, and flying $40 million jets.
That sounds my impression of China, too.
That's, you know, economics 101. There's no true system of government. And never is it more apparent to me than one visit to China. You'll see it right off the bat.
Right.
So, you know, there are Airbus A, you know, 321s and Boeing 737s and everything you can imagine. Big jets, they don't blink an eye at that. That's just another transport jet.
Right.
They've seen a million of those. But it's really cool. You show up in a caravan and they get all excited. And they come out with the press. There'll be all these newspaper reporters with video cameras. And they all want to ask you questions. How was the flight? Like you're an Olympic, you know, gold
Charles
medalist.
Lindbergh.
Yeah. And, they have garlands of flowers that they put on you and bouquets of flowers, and they all want to take pictures, and they're all excited, and there's all these authorities standing around in uniforms. There's, you know, the regular authorities like the immigration and customs will be there and the police. But everybody, you know, it's an excuse. So you show up in a caravan and there's like 150 people standing around for an hour. And then they all disappear. So.
But who are you delivering to? If there aren't that many smaller planes there.
When I first started going there, I was delivering these small planes like caravans to airlines that they were trying to branch out into general aviation. So we had some planes that they were going to use. I'm not even sure they knew what they were going to use them for. This one of the funny things over there is that they have a lot of money right now, and they want to spend it. And one of the things they can spend it on is cool little airplanes. So they're not even sure what they're going to do with them.
Huh. And I know when I first met you, you were taking a caravan on amphibs over.
Right, and they proceeded to damage all those amphibs. They had a neat idea to start a seaplane service in the Yellow Sea.
Okay.
But they operated those amphib caravans in waves that were too big, and they ended up damaging all of them.
Huh, were Chinese pilots flying them? Or
Chinese pilots,
okay.
Yeah. That's a whole other story.
Well, but I've been digging around to some operation in China. I found a caravan outfit in Western China, which is basically sounded very much like a Alaskan-style air taxi. And then I found a float operation, I think it was on the southeast coast.
Now, you see, that's where these make a lot more sense. Now, I've been delivering them to places like Jinan, and which is between Beijing and Shanghai, and Ningbo and Nanjing and Xi'an. So these are all big city areas, where they're not going to be flying those planes a lot. Now, what you're saying, Western China, makes a lot more sense because they're smaller airstrips and smaller demands.
Right. Of course, they have the issues with a lot of that's the Uyghur area, and there are political issues out that direction, too.
And I don't know anything about seaplane operation down in the southeast, but that's the perfect place for it.
Okay. So there's some islands out there, and they're resorts, and they were flying from the bigger cities to these resorts. Otherwise, you took a boat. And the boat was, you know, a 4 or 5 hour boat ride or a 30-minute plane ride.
Right, so just like the Maldives.
Exactly, yeah. And it sounded like they were recruiting Western pilots, is why I asked about, you know, who was flying them.
So, to go back, you know, I don't get to see these planes in actual operation. So they have an idea what they're going to do with them. Some of them are going to be air taxi. They're, you know, equivalent of 135.
Okay.
A lot of them are going to be privately operated.
Like privately owned? Kind of like a GA system or
yes.
A corporate?
Yes, exactly. More like corporate.
Okay.
And because you don't get a lot of owner pilots over there.
Right.
They hire pilots. And then, I can't remember the third thing I was going to say.
We'll think of it later. How, when you talk about the hundreds of people meeting you.
I'm sorry.
Oh, go for
camera platforms.
Oh.
Even though the satellite imagery is so sophisticated today, there's still a demand in the world for light aircraft as a camera platform for doing photogrammetry, you know, aerial surveys.
Yeah.
And aerial photography. So it seems that, like I said, even with, you know, this crazy good resolution in satellite imagery, it seems that the market for light aircraft, you know, aerial photography, it's just not going away.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah, so that's good news.
Yeah, I wonder if that's partly, I think drones may take that over in the next 20 years, but I wonder if that's partly because not everybody has access to that satellite imagery.
Well, it's expensive, and you have to book your time.
Right.
It's a different kind of process.
Right. You get more if it's your plane. You get more freedom to use it how and where you want.
Exactly.
Although I'm curious how the Chinese will, how much freedom they'll give these planes to fly around and take pictures. That would be another thought. And I know this from actually the East Horizon. I was talking to in Afghanistan. That company, they're looking at some Chinese built Anatovs. So there are some aircraft manufacturing companies.
Like an Antonov AN-2?
Yeah, an AN.
Equivalent?
Not an AN-2. They were looking at, was it the AN? I'm going to totally botch the numbers, but I'm not going to try it. But some of these STOL planes that the Antonovs have, the engine sits on top of the wing. Hmm. It's a high wing. The engine sits on top of it. And then some other ones. They're looking at rebuilding these basically Russian transport planes.
So this is another thing that they're trying to do over there. You know, we manufacture all our stuff over there. We're buying stuff, not all our stuff, that's an exaggeration, but it seems like just about everything's made in China. In fact, Kenmore is starting to build their floats in China.
Oh.
They own Edo, and they got a manufacturing place in China.
As cheap labor.
The Chinese, they would love to build these small planes, but they keep buying them. Cessna has had negotiations for years about making a caravan factory over in China, but that doesn't seem to be going anywhere. So,
well, I wonder if I have some information about the Lance Air operation they used to, which Cessna bought. That was in Bend, Oregon, and they moved that to Mexico with fairly disastrous results. Hmm. You don't hear much about Lance Airs anymore.
Yeah, Mexico's even closer
and cheaper, but there were production issues, and I suspect they might have some of those same issues.
So, you know, over in Asia, what I've seen in my lifetime is a history of, you know, the same things happen. Started in Japan. When I was a kid, if it was made in Japan, then it was crap. By the time I was a teenager, Toyotas were out, and they were better than anything that was made in North America.
Yeah.
And then there was Taiwan. And so tools, if it was made in Taiwan, it was crap. But then the best, like, power tools for woodworking that weren't made in the United States, they came from Taiwan. They were excellent quality. When I lived in Africa in the 90s, anything that came from China was a complete piece of junk. But now they're working at it.
Bringing that level up.
The standards of quality are coming up.
Well, the Antonov, sorry to interrupt there, but that's what the CEO of East Horizon, that Afghan company, was saying, that they could buy an Antonov, but I don't think they were making new ones. They were going to buy an older one that was really beat up, or then go to China and buy these new Antonovs, which are they're copies of the Antonovs, which had glass cockpits, fully modernized. And he said they were high quality. So it seems like, to get back to China, it does seem like there's a big push in China to push, a big aviation push in China, whether it's manufacturing or trying to get these smaller airlines going.
Right. So there's plenty of people in the public who have this idea, you know, and they're excited about it, and they got the financing for it. But, again, it's an authoritarian government, and it's very, very hard to break new ground over there. Their entire way of thinking, you know, for generations has been that you never think outside the box. You don't innovate. You don't take risks. You never stick your neck out. So there are plenty of people that want to do this, but it's still a real, you know, uphill battle for them.
Until the government decides that they want it to happen.
The floodgates haven't opened, but right. They're allowing this stuff to go on.
Cool. So slow progress.
And it's definite progress. The planes keep going over there. And I think what I was getting at before is that they would love to build their own planes. They would love to reverse engineer the stuff that we bring over. But they're not at that point yet. They still can't make all their own small airplanes. And they are not reverse engineering caravans and Kodiaks. So they just want to put down their cash and have the airplane over there. And for the foreseeable future, that's the way it's going to be.
Okay, that's good for us. So, as a pilot, how are you treated? You said a lot of people meet the airplane, but in different countries, like U.S., you land and you're a pilot, and you're just the pilot. I mean, there's nothing special about it. But other countries, you're sometimes treated in an exalted fashion. What's the how do they treat pilots in China?
Well, the other pilots and the other people that are associated with the business of the airplane are happy to see you and very, you know, welcoming. And it's important to go out and have a really good meal so they can express, you know, their
gratitude for bringing the plane.
And but when it comes to like the immigration and customs, you're just another machine.
Okay.
And you need to have everything in order.
Right.
You need to have all your paperwork and you need to do things in the right order. One of the things that happened to me this last time, last week I delivered November 101 Kilo Quebec to Nanjing, and it was the third delivery to Nanjing since Christmas. And I arrived 30 minutes before dark, bad weather, and the guys that were expecting me didn't know that I had landed. So the marshal met me out there, and then everybody disappeared. And I was standing out there by myself, and I phoned the guy, and he goes, "Oh, you're here. I didn't know you're here." And he came out and got me, and we decided we would detank the plane in the morning, right? So I go inside to clear immigration, and it took an hour.
Huh.
Because they felt that I had overstepped the rules because they wanted to meet me at the airplane.
Right.
So I had to make some phone calls. I had to get a couple of guys from the company together. We had to sit there. I had to give them all kinds of paperwork. I had to stand in front of them and answer questions for a while. And the whole time he knew he was going to let me into the country.
Right.
But he had to make some phone calls and you know, cover his ass.
Bureaucracy.
Right. And when, like, an hour of bureaucracy had elapsed, then finally he stamped my passport because he didn't get to come out and meet me at the airplane and be there when the airplane stopped rolling and when the door opened on the airplane.
Right.
It was real important to this guy that the proper procedures were followed.
Right.
And I can't blame him. The same thing here in the United States.
Absolutely. If you leave the plane before they meet you, you're
in deep shit.
Yeah. Yeah. What's air traffic control like in China? Pretty organized or?
They're pretty organized. Things are a little bit different. It can be a little frustrating. Part of it is the language barrier.
Right.
Right off the bat, sometimes you're going to, you know, half of their radios are crap.
Huh.
So they've got all this great new infrastructure, but, you know, I can complain about how crappy their radio is, but some of them are perfectly fine.
It's like they've upgraded some and not other ones.
Right. But they're not just going to, like, be tripping over themselves to fix a radio that's transmitting poorly, right? Or
right.
Try a different transmitter. They're just going to keep talking. Part of it is a language barrier because they're speaking English, but it's very difficult for them to pronounce a lot of words. So
right.
In a lot of these Asian countries, you have a very difficult time in asking them sometimes 10 times. And so you can't lose your cool. You say, well, you know, please say it again slowly. I didn't quite understand you, whatever. The important thing is that they communicate the information to you. They're trying.
Right. Well, it's like flying in New York. And they may not slow down.
Then some of their expectations are going to be different. First of all, you need to be able to fly that your cruising altitude, your flight level is going to be in meters.
Okay.
With the G1000, you can hit the PDF button and go straight over to altitude units.
And change it.
And put it in meters. But when I started doing this, we would have to come with a cheat sheet. Because we were still flying in feet, but I had to have a cheat sheet with the equivalent in meters.
Right.
Because you get over there and somebody assigns you meters, especially in a in an approach. You're cleared to descend 410 meters, turn left 210, contact, you know, approach on a 125.3. And he's all saying this in an accent that you can barely understand, and it's in bad weather, and it's at night.
And you're
sitting there trying to figure out what the equivalent in feet to meters so that, you know.
Well, that caused problems. If you didn't know that, you might go down to 410 feet.
So that's another thing you really need to be prepared for, so you're not caught with your pants down.
Right. Okay. I think we can wrap this up pretty quick. I want to touch on, you just posted on the network, let me throw this in there first. It's going to be one of our members flying in Saudi now, I believe, but he flew for a year out of Beijing for ambulance, so I'm hoping to get to him and get some more of the inside scoop about flying in China and, you know, whether it's all Chinese nationals they hire, if they frequently hire Westerns.
Well, I asked the other day, and I actually ask every time I go, and all the times I've been going, you see a few Western pilots over there flying, but typically they want Chinese pilots.
Right, and then they've got the population base and now the money on the eastern side of China.
However, they need us to train them.
Right, especially in the newer planes.
And when I was delivering to Shandong Airlines in Jinan, I met a Welshman that was training them in the RJs.
Okay.
They had a bunch of new CRJs. He was a training captain. And it's the same thing now. The pilots have been coming over here with these Kodiaks and getting training at the factory. And Quest has a simulator in Spokane.
Huh.
So they are coming through, spending, you know, a couple of weeks here. They're getting actual training in the airplane, and they're spending much of simulator time, and they go back over there. And they're pretty switched on now. There's another thing I'd like to touch on is that I was talking about the authoritarian culture.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a lot of these countries, like, not so much Japan, not in my lifetime anyway, but China, South Korea, these Asian countries, Malaysia, you know, their way of, oh, and Russia, especially Russia, their way of thinking in business and in personal life is that you never stick your neck out and you don't take responsibility. You always kick the responsibility upstairs. And if there's any question, there's no question. You don't you don't sign your name on a dotted line until somebody with a higher authority has given you permission to do that.
Huh, okay.
And that is, as far as being a pilot in command of an aircraft, that's the absolute opposite. It's the antithesis of the North American concept of what it is to be a pilot in command. And right there in the regulations, what is it, 91-103 or whatever,
yeah, where... that actually sounds about right.
You know, you're the pilot in command is responsible for and the final authority as to that flight.
And you can deviate from any FAR in the interest of safety.
Right.
I mean, the FAA actually gives you that authority.
In an emergency, you can deviate from the emergency. If air traffic control is giving an instruction, normally it's illegal to deviate from that instruction. But if it's contrary to safety, you will deviate from that instruction. And you need to be able to stand up and in a moment make that decision and tell a controller negative.
Right.
Unable.
You're saying sort of the culture over there doesn't seem to be quite that way.
It's not even quite that way. These people are raised and it's ingrained. They're brought up and it's hammered into them that you never question authority. You never deviate from instructions. You never make up your own mind. You do what you're told.
So do you think that translates into the cockpit where a PIC might not be...
They've got a long history of it translating into the cockpit. Okay. It's resulted in a lot of accidents and deaths. Now, there has been a long history of that, but in the last couple of decades, that's been recognized, and they've adopted more of kind of a worldwide concept of safety, crew resource management, and they're all recognizing this is really important. And there are two reasons for it. One, I think, is just plain common sense, but another big one is that they just plain weren't even allowed to come and fly over into the United States or into U.S. territories.
Right.
If they couldn't prove that they had these standards. That's right.
Well, that Aviana crash made.
That was one of them. You're talking about San Francisco last year?
Yeah, that was kind of the throwback to maybe some older style thinking.
Well, there's a famous one of Korean Air flying into Guam.
Uh-huh, yep.
And they crashed a 747, controlled flight into terrain. Guy flew right into a mountain at night in the rain. There was a first officer and a flight engineer that knew exactly what was happening, but they couldn't speak up to the captain, and everybody was killed.
Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen a transcript, actually, from the air traffic control and some of the communication that went on from that accident.
There's another accident in Switzerland about 10 years ago where there was a UPS 757 and a Russian jet with 78 school kids on board. And the somebody got a TCAS alert, asked for different altitude, and ATC didn't see the conflict and told them negative. So everybody held their altitude, and they had a mid-air collision, and everybody was killed.
Huh.
And if you or I were flying, and we had a TCAS alert, and a guy said negative, I'm not going to sit there. Personally, I'm not going to keep flying at that if I see an accident about to happen. I'm going to deviate and deal with the consequences of having to write a report.
Well, and you hear this actually flying anywhere, actually, in the U.S. internationally, too. You'll hear jets actually make that call from numerous nationalities, like deviation for thunderstorms. I've heard ATC deny them, and I've heard captains just come right up and say, we're turning right 30 degrees. And ATC, this is, I'm thinking, the Middle East has happened. I've heard it quite a bit. You'll hear Cairo will come back, in an uproar. Oh, you can't do that. And then they'll of course, let
them. So personally, I think it's really important for Chinese pilots to be able to speak good English. Because English really is the international language of aviation.
Right. That's a good point to make, because I always feel bad when I say other countries should speak English and I don't speak any other languages, but it is the language of aviation.
So yeah, we're in this kind of privileged position as Americans.
We are.
As English speakers. Native English speakers.
Yeah.
That's number one. Number two, it really helps if they've been educated over here, not just because overcoming the language barrier, but because they've learned how to think and overcome this kind of mindset of that they're brought up with in an authoritarian society.
Right, or to think a little more for themselves, maybe.
Absolutely, cool. A lot more for themselves. And third, they need to be trained over here. And because they will be trained over there.
Right, yep.
But if they're only trained under their own system, and their own system is different, you know, there are little subtle differences, but there are also some, you know, everything is not standardized. It's supposed to be.
Right.
No, but it's different.
It's not. When we get back in the ferry flying course, if all you've done is fly in the U.S., you run into problems when you go overseas and you don't educate yourself as to how other countries have different regs in terms of transition altitudes and VFR altitude. We don't need to go into all that now, but so I think that's true anything.
So, like, one of the things that a lot of these countries do for... If you ask them for something that is, they don't know what you're asking for, they'll just ignore you.
Right.
You're flying along and you say, I want to change altitude, and they'll just say negative. They say, and they won't give you a reason why. If you ask a question about the weather, if you ask a question about your routing, if you ask a question about, being able to, change altitude coming up. If you ask a question about, the airspace, you're supposed to have all this in their mind. You're supposed to know all the answers already.
Right.
They're going to tell you what to do and you do it. And if they don't understand the question that you're asking them or your explanation for their question, they're just going to ignore you.
Right. And you just need to keep asking them, is what I've found.
Right.
I mean, it's
the only you have to insist. Yeah. Very often, though, they're just going to tell you no. But it's amazing because... If you're in America and you ask an air traffic controller a question, he's going to respond to you. If you're in China and you ask him a question and he doesn't understand the question, he's not even going to answer you.
Right, I've seen that.
And so you ask him again, and then he's going to answer you, and he's going to ask, what are you asking me? And you ask him the question, and he still doesn't understand it, and he's just going to say no. So you got to be ready for that.
Yes, I was talking to a guy, he was flying in Mongolia, and he was flying a crop duster, and he was flying, I forgot what he was doing exactly, but he was on the Mongolia-Chinese border, and the Mongolians had insisted that he maintain this, like every half hour he'd call in and report his new
position report.
Right, exactly. And he thought that it wasn't a whole lot of reason for this, that he's in radar contact, or I forgot his reasoning. But at some point, he's right on the Chinese border, and the Chinese call up the Mongolians and say, there's an airplane, we have a radar hit on our border. If you don't acknowledge or tell us who it is, if you don't know who it is, we're going to send fighters and shoot them down. And the Mongolian reporter, he heard all this on the radio. And the Mongolian reporter says, I don't know who that airplane is. And he gets on there, and he's like, that's me, I just called you 5 minutes ago as a position report. So there's certainly some rote conversations that go on, it doesn't always sink in, but... let's move on from that. It's sort of like our ferry flying discussion, I think, for the future. I do want to touch on the post you put on recently about the Andaman Islands, or Andaman India.
So I've got a friend who, we did a ferry flight together to Africa when he was flying in Tanzania. And he's back in India now, and he's flying caravans, and his company has a little operation, a seaplane operation. They're starting up in the Andaman Islands. The Andamans are in the Bay of Bengal. They're west of the Malaysian Peninsula. It's a really neat little place.
Huh.
And they're going to have two amphibian caravans there, and they need a training captain to come out and help them get this thing off the water.
So they're going to be training Indian pilots to fly these planes.
Yes.
And so it's someone to go over and kind of sort of like I did with the Nepalese.
But they want for a longer period. They're
right.
Basically for the better part of a year.
Oh, Gomer wanted me longer. I mean, they wanted... I just didn't have
to. I remember they wanted us in Nepal for 6 months. So this is the same kind of thing, 6 to 8 months.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
If you just find somebody that wanted to go do it, then he would have a great time.
Yeah, that would actually be. I know it's tempting, but I mean, like I said, I'm lined up with Ken Moore this summer.
So the Nicobar and Andaman Islands. So it's breaking new ground.
Cool. That would be. Yeah, I've seen other caravan jobs in India advertised in various spots. So there are positions in India, not just China, for non-Indian pilots to fly. Which is kind of cool. Somebody look at it. Moldavian Air Taxi has been looking for captains for their Twin Otter. So sort of the finishing there is seems like now is a good time to be a pilot. There are a lot of jobs. A lot of companies are looking for pilots right now.
And this one, they're not going to pay you. You're not going to be a millionaire, but I told him, you got to start at $4,000 a month.
Right, and they cover probably a lot of your expenses, too.
Travel expenses from your home country and your living expenses and your transportation from your... it would be an apartment.
It's flying tourist operations?
Yes.
Yeah, out to islands or...
Yes.
Okay, cool. All right, well, I think that's going to wrap it up, unless you got anything more to add.
Well, I wish I could do that job, but I'm... Because that would be fun, but although it's really hot and steamy there, and that's not my favorite climate.
Yeah,
peeling your uniform off at the end of the day because it's stuck to you.
Yeah,
it's not my favorite thing. However,
it'd be a cool job.
It would be pretty cool if you could stick it out for 6 to 8 months. Be something, a great experience you'd never forget, and it would definitely lead to bigger, better things.
Yeah, that's always been my fight with this industry in general, is there are more jobs out there than I can do. It's one reason I started this website, is I now have an excuse to look at all these jobs, even if I can't go do them myself. So if one of you guys out there gets this job, let us know how it goes, because I'm certainly curious. So, Aiden and Alice, Oddball Pilot, over and out.